An invasive insect is killing Pennsylvania's state tree, the eastern hemlock. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant visited an insectary where land stewards are trying a new approach to control hemlock woolly adelgid.
When I meet experts from the Western Pennsylvania Conservancy at the Bear Run Nature Reserve in the Laurel Highlands, the first thing I want to know, what is an insectary?
An insectary is basically a nursery habitat where you grow insects.
Charles Beer is the Conservancy's Director of Conservation Science. To better understand the need for an insectary at Bear Run, his colleague Andy Zednik, Director of Land Stewardship, says we should first take a walk in the woods.
Let's hit some of the trails and find some hemlock trees.
The eastern hemlocks here have come under attack by an aphid-like bug called the hemlock woolly adelgid. Beer points ahead to one of the few green spots in the chilly spring forest.
So that will be a hemlock.
It's a graceful, pyramid-shaped evergreen, but some of its soft, flat needles are looking a little sparse. Beer looks at their underside.
You can see right there, that's definitely hemlock woolly adelgid.
They look like tiny white balls of cotton, clinging where the stem meets the base of the hemlock's short needles. Adelgids, native to Japan, were first found in the eastern U.S. around 1950. The insect has decimated hemlock trees in the southern Appalachians and the Great Smoky Mountains. Beer says once infested, a tree might only last a few years.
And you'll start to see it have branches no longer holding needles, and eventually the tree is just a skeleton. And it dies.
Eastern hemlocks grow near streams and provide shade for brook trout. Many birds also rely on hemlock habitat. And while adelgids have been in the eastern half of Pennsylvania for years, they've been moving westward. Andy Zadnick says around 2009, they were found in the Laurel Highlands, at historic Falling Water and at Ohiopyle State Park.
And when we heard about it at Ohiopyle, we knew it was just a matter of time before it made its way here to Bear Run Reserve.
There is an insecticide that helps control adelgids, but Zadnick says it's been difficult to treat enough trees.
You have to pick one tree versus another tree because it's very labor-intensive and very expensive to treat these individual trees with a chemical.
This is where the insectary comes in. Beer heard about research at Cornell University where they've been releasing a new predator beetle into hemlock groves, one that aggressively eats hemlock woolly adelgids. The insectary at Bear Run doesn't look like much now.
What do we have?
12.
Yeah, 12 little hemlocks.
Working with state foresters, the Conservancy will care for the hemlocks, preparing them to be purposely infected with adelgids.
Essentially, 1 year from now, in March, we'll consider actually starting to infect them if we think they're healthy enough.
If the adelgids take hold in the nursery, the Conservancy will introduce that predatory beetle, the Laricobius nigrinus, or LN, to feed on them. And once they've raised a population of LN beetles, they can release them more widely into Bear Run, in hopes that the beetles will spread, eating adelgids off the hemlocks. LN beetles are native to the Pacific Northwest and the northern Rocky Mountains, and they already exist in eastern Pennsylvania, but they're not native to this region.
We just need to get this predator here in time to stop the hemlocks from dying in large numbers.
But is it really a good idea, releasing a new non-native species into southwestern Pennsylvania forests?
Yeah, we might look like it, but we're not really that dumb. And we're not ready to go out there and create more problems.
That's Mark Whitmore, forest entomologist at Cornell. He's been working with the USDA on regulations for releasing LN beetles to prey on adelgids.
It's like we're certain through our testing that they will only eat the intended prey item. They won't switch to other prey.
Charles Beer is banking on its success. Standing on a small bridge over the stream at Bear Run, Beer considers why the eastern hemlock is so important to him.
In the winter, all of the other trees are barren. There's that iconic, everlasting hemlock tree. It's a very classic tree for the Appalachian Mountains.
Researchers say they can't be certain, but LN beetles appear to be containing woolly adelgid in some areas and gives them hope for the eastern hemlock.
Pennsylvania is an important breeding ground for over 100 species of migratory birds. But some of these birds are in decline, and the state is trying to create more habitat to help them. As the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier explains, sometimes that means using an age-old tool that reshapes forests: fire.
In a clearing in the Allegheny Mountains, 25 men in fire-resistant gear gather in a circle.
today? Did everybody get a hold of a map?
Ben Jones is in charge of the Pennsylvania Game Commission's prescribed fire program. He's telling these men, mostly Game Commission officers with special fire training, about today's controlled burn. Jones begins with a weather report, some safety tips, and tells them what they're trying to accomplish today.
Well, this is part of the area that was heavily hit by gypsy moth around 2008, 2009, with a lot of oak mortality. We're trying to tip that balance back to the oak forest that it was before gypsy moth.
The state's had this prescribed fire program for about a decade to maintain different kinds of habitat across the Game Commission's 1.5 million acres of public game lands. Today's fire will cover a 500-acre strip of it in Center County. Jones takes a crew about 1.5 miles down a dirt road into the forest. At the end, he walks down a path.
Fire has been a part of these habitats for thousands of years. Since the glaciers retreated, fires have been burning through these habitats for, pushing 10,000 years.
Some of these fires were set by Native Americans to promote certain types of berry crops or improve hunting grounds. He says this is basically what the Game Commission is doing today. Jones and his team pick a spot to start the fire, where the wind will keep it from spreading too fast once it's set. Gage Meyer, a Game Commission officer from Cameron County, walks around with a large metal can with a spray nozzle attached at the end.
It's a mixture of diesel fuel and gasoline. It's 4-to-1. It's not too potent, but it does the job.
Meyer ignites a clump of leaves that have been doused with the fuel. From there, he and another crew member spray the fuel in a straight line along the path. The fire quickly spreads. The fire burns knee high, turning leaves on the ground black. A wall of heat pulses off the forest floor. This fire will benefit oak trees and wild turkeys, but it'll also create a home for some rare or threatened songbirds. A few miles away, Jeff Larkin, a biologist at Indiana University of Pennsylvania, walks along a flat ridgetop dotted with small trees.
So these guys live, right? These are pitch pine. Fire came through relatively thick bark.
This forest was burned 2 years ago. There are still scorch marks on some stumps, but small woody plants are quickly taking over the forest floor. Larkin says these fires will help create habitat for some birds that don't need a deep forest to raise their young in.
There are a few species that populations have been plummeting for quite a bit longer, and therefore they're kind of on the conservation radar screen, if you will.
One of the most threatened species is the golden-winged warbler. It's a migratory bird that's currently being considered for protection under the Endangered Species Act. Once abundant, its population has declined by 2/3 since the 1960s. Several states and the federal government are spending millions to keep the species from going extinct. It's a tiny gray bird with splashes of brilliant yellow on its head and wings that give the bird its name. The golden-winged warbler winters in parts of Central and South America that are rapidly being deforested, and then it migrates to North America in the spring, which is pretty amazing for a creature that weighs only 9 grams.
We're talking about like the weight of a quarter or a nickel. Not very much, and you can think about that critter trying to get across the Gulf of Mexico and then find its way back to its breeding grounds.
Those breeding grounds are young forests, like those being created by controlled burns. The birds don't nest high in the trees, but closer to the ground.
Because they got kids that can barely fly. They're trying not to be eaten by hawks and snakes and chipmunks and everything else that wants to eat a songbird. And they're also trying to make sure that there's ample amounts of food.
But that perfect young forest is rare in Pennsylvania. Why? Larkin takes me to another nearby site for the answer. It was burned a couple of years ago, but small trees and shrubs are growing back. A century ago, Larkin says, this field would have probably been clear-cut, like the rest of Pennsylvania's forests.
We could all go back in our time machines before any of us were around, think about the massive landscape-scale clearing of our forests that occurred. When that happened, all of our forests, basically their age became reset.
So most forest in the state is about 100 years old. Larkin says this is bad, not just for golden-winged warblers, but for other species that evolved to survive in specific types of forests or wetlands.
Think about our forests before that happened. The thousands of years of structural complexity that developed.
That complexity is in evidence at this site that was burned a few years ago. A few lone hickory trees stand in a sea of blackberry bushes and oak and maple saplings.
Here's a great example of what we call the golden-winged warbler nesting habitat. If we got out in there, you'd have areas of some grasses and some ferns and some other pockets of like goldenrod. And those are the places that they like to seek out to build a nest and to raise their young.
And with any luck, golden-winged warblers will be able to raise their young here this summer.
Bats and songbirds are in trouble in Pennsylvania, so the government has turned to private landowners to protect their habitat. More than 70% of land in Pennsylvania is privately owned. Each year, about 400 landowners manage their property for threatened and endangered species. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant visited one family in Blair County and has their story.
To find Tom Belinda's house in Williamsburg near Altoona, you wind through a small community of homes and fields along the river valley and up a nearly 2-mile-long gravel driveway. Finally, the woods break open to a clearing and a mountain lodge home that's made of logs. After a wet greeting from two black Newfoundlands,
this one might lick you to death.
Belinda leads me to the second-story deck, which looks out over his 1,300-acre wooded valley.
Yep, I never want to leave the mountain, man. I'll tell you.
He's a forester and a hunter wearing a ball cap and camouflage pants, and he quickly spots deer in the distance.
See him walking in the woods to the left?
Oh, yeah. I see.
There's three of them. There's another little one.
Belinda and his wife bought this property 20 years ago when the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service contacted him about managing his land to improve habitat for endangered Indiana bats. He laughed. He points to the eaves under his roof. He was already providing them habitat.
And I'm like, yeah, you guys want me to manage all this stuff for the woods. And I said, you can just come up underneath my poles of my house and I can show them right where they're at it every day.
But as he looked into it, Belinda says managing his land for bat habitat made sense. He's surrounded by state game lands and other private property, much of it part of a corridor of nearly 21,000 acres of protected bat habitat. And then there's the bat cave. He points out from his deck at the cave where these tiny mouse-eared bats, weighing as little as 3 pennies, hibernate in the winter.
Which you can see over there past that red topped house, there's Canoe Creek Lake over there, and there's an actual well-known bat hibernacula that where they go in the wintertime.
According to the Natural Resources Conservation Service, a branch of the USDA, a 2015 survey of that bat cave found the number of bats had dropped from 32,000 to just 70. Indiana bats have suffered from habitat loss and white nose syndrome and are listed under the Endangered Species Act. Belinda saw an opportunity to help and to secure the future of his property.
I looked at my wife one day and I said, are we ever going to put any buildings? We're never going to develop this. She's like, heck no. And I'm like, then why not just put it in this program? I said, at least when we're dead and gone, nobody can do it. So now it stays like this for forever.
Belinda put more than half his property into a conservation easement, which means the land can never be developed, even if it's sold. He gets tax breaks for that. He takes me out in a small off-road vehicle to look at how he's managed the land for bats over the past 5 years. We drive down some rocky pathways into the valley to a spot where he's trying to get the trees to grow bigger.
Yep, see, this is the bad area.
In summer, as many as 100 females form colonies in older, larger trees like hickory and ash, where they crawl underneath the warm, shaggy bark to roost. Each raises only one pup a season. This is why Belinda has cleared smaller trees in this area and points to a larger one that remains.
We're going to try to grow it quicker. At a quicker state, quicker than what it normally would. The only way to do that is to remove all the competition.
The Natural Resources Conservation Service shares his costs. Last year, the agency paid Pennsylvania landowners nearly $250,000 to remove invasives. As the sun goes down, we head back to his house and look out over the deck. One by one, a few small bats slip out from the woodwork and into the night.
There's another one. You see it? See, that came out right here.
Belinda says they're headed down the valley toward the river to eat insects. His government partners say efforts by private land stewards like Belinda are giving the bats and warblers a chance to survive in the forests of Pennsylvania.
Many bat species are reliable predators for beetles, mosquitoes, and other bugs. But white nose syndrome has killed millions of bats in the U.S. since 2006. Some researchers in Pennsylvania say they may have a new idea about how to slow the spread of the disease. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier found one experiment that could help keep bats in Pennsylvania skies for years to come.
To save the bats of Pennsylvania, Greg Turner wants to build a better bat cave. He's taken me to his latest renovation project, a cave under a hillside in central Pennsylvania.
So this is the very upper section, and this whole cave is going to slope downhill.
Turner is a biologist with the Pennsylvania Game Commission. He's taken me to Indian Caverns. It used to be a commercial cave. There's still an abandoned gift shop outside and fake display plants inside the cave. The state is in the process of acquiring it as a way to preserve bats. The room he's taken me to is full of stalactites hanging from above. In between those stalactites, there are cavities about the size of a fist. These are perfect resting spots for hibernating bats.
They'll put their whole body up against that rock because they like it to be really stable, stable temperatures. And so if you're surrounded by that rock is going to stay the same temperature pretty much all winter long.
Those stable temperatures are important for their hibernation. In contrast to popular belief, bats aren't really sleeping when they hibernate, but their body temperature drops along with the rest of its systems.
And that's why white nose syndrome was so deadly to them, because they come into hibernation, they shut down their immune system, they shut down their metabolism, their breathing comes down.
This makes them susceptible to the fungus that causes white nose syndrome, Pseudogymnoascus destructens. It's so destructive because it's not like other fungi, which eat dead and decaying matter. Instead, and you might want to cover your ears for this, white nose fungus feasts on living cells. A hibernating bat is an easy target.
And then this fungus just starts eating on them while they're in this state. And then they come out of that state and they're like, whoa, you know, what's going on?
The fungus creates whitish infections on the bat's face, clustered around its nose, hence the name. The bat expends energy fighting off the infection during hibernation. In its weakened state, it can be easily preyed upon by other species when it leaves the cave. The disease has annihilated bat populations, particularly in the Northeast, since it was first discovered about 12 years ago in upstate New York. That includes several species of bats that used to roost in this cave. Hundreds once hibernated here. Now, there are only a few.
And that's not uncommon. We saw sites that had 40, 50,000 bats go down to single digits.
But in some places, bat populations have survived, which prompted a question for Turner and his colleagues.
What's going on at those spots? Why are the bats doing better here? Or why are they aggregating here? And what we found is those sites were a lot colder.
The ground temperature in Pennsylvania is around 53 degrees Fahrenheit. But depending on airflow, some caves can get down to 40 or lower, making it harder for the fungus to spread. How do you get a cave to cool down? Well, think of a lake.
The way you cool off a site like this is looking at the physics of air, just like water would be the same. In a lake, the coldest spot of a lake is down low.
And the same is true of a cave. Cool air sinks to the lowest spot. But cold air can't build up in Indian Caverns because its former owners sealed it off, in some parts to keep tourists from wandering away. Turner says that will change as part of the state's renovations.
So over here is a big concrete wall. And this was the original opening to the cave. This was a big sinkhole opening. And it goes up maybe about 10 feet or so above the ceiling.
The Game Commission is planning to take the wall out and reopen a vent into the cave from the original opening. That'll allow more cold air to come into the cave and accumulate in its lower reaches. Turner takes me down a series of passageways that wind downward about 100 feet below ground. An underground stream runs alongside the path, which is lit only by our headlamps. He looks overhead. There's rocks where he hopes that this winter bats can roost. So, can bats come back from white nose syndrome? It's a hard question to answer, Turner says.
But I would be satisfied at this point just seeing the population stabilize and maybe some slight increases, you know, as far as my lifetime goes. And, you know, looking towards the future generations, for them to be able to see these species would be a great achievement, I think.
The Game Commission will begin work on the cave this summer. With any luck, bats will be hibernating in a cooled-off Indian caverns by the winter.
For people searching for the best fly fishing spots to catch wild trout in the U.S., central Pennsylvania still makes top 10 lists. That's despite historical pollution and runoff from agriculture and development. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant heads to the region to find out how people there are working to keep these premier streams clean.
It's just before sunset, and 27-year-old Matt Kowalczyk is standing in the river near the bank of Penn's Creek in central Pennsylvania, not far from State College. He's a fly fishing guide and chooses a lure meant to catch wild trout.
We're going to see if we can get one to eat a stonefly. It's hard to pass up a big meal.
Kowalczyk attaches the fly to his line and walks deeper into the center of the fast-moving creek. He casts upstream. His line doesn't dance through the air like in a river runs through it, but his lure lands lightly on the water and floats down a ways. No bites, so he pulls it out and casts upstream again.
And you do it again, and you do it again, and you do it again, and you do it again. The next thing you know, boom, a bar of gold just rolls up and annihilates your fly. Yeah, it's pretty intense. It gets the adrenaline pumping.
Kowalczyk considered moving to Montana or Colorado after college, but he loves it here.
In the middle of Pennsylvania, mountains all around you, watching the bald eagles chase the osprey for the trout.
In high summer, the water is still cool, maybe 60 degrees, and remains that temperature because it's fed by cold springs and mountain creeks. Unlike some streams, the state doesn't stock Penn's Creek with trout.
It doesn't need it. This stream is Class A wild trout water, meaning that it has a naturally sustaining population of fish that does not need us to do anything about. If you come here in October and November, you can walk the stream and find the fish actively spawning, and that is cool to see.
One reason the trout do well here, abundant food. When I visited, Kowalczyk was just finishing up with the angling frenzy around the hatch of green drake and especially large mayfly.
And that's a huge draw. That is the big hatch here. That's the reason everyone comes to fish, the green drake. It's actually pretty insane.
Even closer to State College in nearby Spring Creek, a spill of cyanide at Penn State in the 1950s wiped out the green drake population. The mayflies have never recovered there. Now, the Clean Water Act protects these creeks from large-scale chemical dumping. It's led to improvements in sewage treatment and stormwater management, and wild trout populations have rebounded. There's usually not one big pollution source anymore. Today, it's more like death by a thousand cuts. Urbanization and growth in State College, like rooftops, roads, and parking lots, cause runoff and pollution in Spring Creek. In the more rural Penn's Creek watershed, it's the farms. One-third of the land here is in agriculture, corn, soy, and dairy.
This was a cow pasture, and that was a cow pasture.
David Martinick is working with the Penn's Valley Conservation Association, a local nonprofit, to restore the stream bed at his longtime family farm. He points to the high bank on the far side of the creek where a backhoe is moving hemlock logs brought in for a restoration project.
And we took the cattle off. The non-native invasive species just grew up and just choked everything out.
Martinick wanted to encourage native wildlife, woodcock and songbirds here, but he got inundated with invasives instead, like autumn olive and Chinese honeysuckle.
And what happens when you start choking out the native plants and the grasses, the little seeds and the little things that the little birds and that, they leave.
The Conservation Association's Lyle Sherwin, who leads many area landowners on projects like this, says the bare soil of the cow pastures left these stream banks without tree roots for structure.
They're falling into the stream. massive erosion.
You can see silt from the eroding bank filling up the shallow stream here. Sherman says this limestone bed is spawning ground for trout, and the sediment literally smothers their eggs. That's why they're building what's basically a reinforced wall of logs along the stream.
It simulates an eroded bank that has structure and function to it, but it's a built bank. It's a stable bank.
Sherwin has worked on 14 improvement projects like this in recent years and says the more they do, the more landowners want to try it.
It's sort of keeping up with the Joneses. Oh, wait a minute, they did that stream project and it worked for them and they seem happy with it.
Many of these projects get funding through a USDA program that's proposed to be cut in the House version of the 2018 Farm Bill. Sherwin hopes funding doesn't dry up because the more stream restoration, the better for the wild brown trout in Penn's Creek and for the anglers who pour in to catch them.
Nearly 1,800 acres of state-owned forest in Pennsylvania have been cleared for natural gas drilling over the past decade. That's wiped out habitat for many native species. For our Wild PA series, the Allegheny Friends' Reed Frazier checked in with researchers who are trying to bring some of it back.
Kelly Sitch is an ecologist with the Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, and right now he's walking in a clearing deep in the Tyodotten State Forest in north-central Pennsylvania. We're surrounded by wildflowers and tall grasses in what is essentially an outdoor laboratory.
Here's a mix that was all native grasses and wildflowers. As you can see right now, this appears to be solid wild bergamot.
Sitch and a group of scientists have divvied up this clearing into dozens of small plots, each planted with different species. The one we're standing next to was planted with wild bergamot. It's a native species with light purple flowers that look like pom-poms. Butterflies and bees hover over these chest-high flowers on this warm summer morning.
This is only a 13 by 13 foot square, but to a bumblebee, this is a fantastic ecosystem right here. So it wouldn't take a very large portion of a well-pad edge to provide a lot of ecosystem benefits.
DCNR has leased over 100,000 acres of state forest to the gas industry for fracking in the Marcellus Shale. Here in the Tyodotten, the industry has cut down around 1,000 acres of forest to make way for well pads, pipelines, and compressor stations. Sitch says most of this land won't be grown back as forests, at least not for decades.
But there's a lot of areas around the edge of the well pad that have been cleared, or perhaps areas that were used to store water trucks or fracking equipment that's no longer necessary when it's just in production.
And it's these areas, around the edges of gas development, that Sitch and his colleagues like Patrick Drohan want to resuscitate. Drohan, a soil scientist at Penn State, says the problem isn't just that the forest has been cut down. To build a well pad, companies use heavy equipment to compact the ground underneath.
Most of the time, what's done for these types of operations is they compact to what's called no movement. And that standard is similar when you're building a parking lot. It's similar to when you're building a shale gas pad.
And that's not good for plants to grow in. Compacted soil has fewer pores to store water or gases that a plant needs to survive.
So in this case, what we're trying to do is alleviate deep compaction. And to do that, you need to use big equipment to rip the soil.
The team brought in a bulldozer with a special attachment on it to cut into the compacted soil. Basically, they tilled the ground to varying depths to see which depth worked best. One row at the far end of the plot has not been loosened at all. Not surprisingly, it's doing worse than the other rows.
That far row is much less drought tolerant than the other three rows, and we're seeing a lot more non-native invasive species that can still tolerate that very dry soil.
The goal is to give gas companies step-by-step instructions for repairing and replanting the borders of their well pads, pipelines, and other construction areas. He doesn't think cost should be a problem for most companies.
You're really getting down to almost less than $2,000 an acre, which may be a lot of money to you and I, but when you're talking about multi-million dollar operations over many sites, it's not really very much of a money commitment.
For now, the agency isn't proposing to make any of these methods mandatory. The Tyodotten State Forest is 150,000 acres. Sitch says even if they can only restore a few hundred of these, that would be worth it.
If we're creating habitat for insects, for songbirds, butterflies and moths, native plants, that's a great deal of real estate